I Hate Politics is a podcast dedicated to exploring a human activity we love to hate. We look at human life, culture, economics closest to us, in our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and in our local governments. Together, we'll explore how politics is central to getting things done in societies where we treasure diverse views and preferences. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I've spent my life studying politics, and I know this. Unless we want to live in a dictatorship or a monarchy, we are stuck with politics. Politics is more than just Trump, Biden, or elections. It's how we fix potholes, make our streets safer, where we put our schools, and decide who goes to them. It's about coming together as a community. It's about us. Let's go find those stories. In this episode, we look at the White's Ferry debacle and its implications for the public-private partnerships with Montgomery County Council member from District 1, Andrew Friedson. If you don't know White's Ferry, it's a car barge that connects Poolesville in Montgomery County, Maryland, to Loudoun County in Virginia. It's the only way to cross the Potomac River between American Legion Bridge on the Capitol Beltway and Point of Rocks, which is many miles north. The ferry has been running, with some interruptions, for over 200 years, which makes it both an infrastructure project and a historic monument, so to speak. The ferry stopped this January because of a commercial dispute between the owners of the ferry in Maryland and the owners of the landing spot on the Loudoun County side. 600 cars use the ferry every day. The latest is that we are headed towards some resolution. But what does it mean for a private company to own critical infrastructure? What does it say about the Purple Line, the biggest public-private transit partnership in the country that had been in trouble until recently? In this episode, we also debut I Hate Politics upcountry correspondent Andrew Sondry. Andrew is a Germantown native and really excited to report on his underreported upcountry hometown. If you have stories to share, please reach out to him. I think Twitter is best, but I'll ask him. If you heard episode 2, which looked at different advocacy styles, we got some feedback. Miriam Schoenbaum, who I interviewed about her work on pedestrian safety, had this to ask. Maybe the question is, why does MCPS allow outsiders inside to advocate? And MCDOT, which is Montgomery County Department of Transportation, and the State Highway Administration, why they do not? I think we're looking at an episode comparing organizational cultures. Thank you, Miriam. Now, the news roundup. MCPS has proposed a plan to reopen in-person school, but the plan hasn't been convincing. Teachers and staff are up in protest and organized a car rally on February 23rd at MCPS Central Office in Rockville. This is what it sounded like. You get the picture. Board of Education is, of course, still only meeting online, so the question is whether someone heard the honking. As all the car honking was going down, MCPS announced a big move, a plan to shift a quarter of its 1,400 school buses to electric. The school district signed a $169 million multi-year contract to lease electric buses, which is really good news for the county and the environment. Not sure what the fine print is just yet, but we'll be following this closely. In more education news, the Federal Department of Education is insisting that schools across the county complete their standardized testing regimen. In Maryland, the State Department of Education has reduced some testing requirements, but some remain in place. Together, Montgomery County teachers say we are looking at anything between 8 to 20 days of testing. The calculations vary, of course, but there is no denying the opportunity cost. Most of these tests are meant for high-level state and district decision-making and not really very useful for classroom teachers. Some see the testing decision as a way of ensuring school districts pay millions of dollars to education technology companies who own and manage the tests. We'll be talking about COVID impacts for many years, but this one is close to us. In the first episode of the podcast, I'd interviewed community activists from Forest Glen and Montgomery Hills in southeastern Montgomery County about the street redesign of Georgia Avenue. A big part of that redesign was a new metro entrance that was going to be built on the eastern side of Georgia Ave. Montgomery County Executive has decided to delay that project. Here is Pratap Verma of Forest Glen.
The county executive has proposed delaying the Forest Glen Passageway project by 2 years, reducing the current CIP, or the Capital Improvements Program allocation, by about $4.95 million. Design would begin in this delay in during fiscal year 23, and construction would begin in fiscal year 25. The main issue with this delay is that it prevents or possibly even delays the ability to develop the east side of Georgia Avenue at the Forest Glen Medical Site, as well as the WMATA 8-acre parcel.
This year's been a snowy year, and shoveling is on my mind. Have you noticed, however, that we spend public money to shovel snow off streets, but sidewalks, we leave those for homeowners to shovel? What does this say about what we value in society? Walkers or drivers? Now, County Council member Evan Glass has introduced a bill that will make Montgomery County Department of Transportation the agency responsible for clearing snow from the roads, also responsible for clearing snow off some sidewalks. Don't throw those shovels out yet. Glass's bill is limited to certain equity areas along the densest population corridors in the county. Shoveling sidewalks remains one of the few remaining chores that teenagers use to make money, but I've been told that kids are not out with shovels these days. I'll be back with Andrew Friedman. Andrew Friedman, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thanks, glad to be here.
Tell me, let's start at the beginning. What is the history and importance of White's Ferry to the region, to Montgomery County, and to your district where it is?
Well, White's Ferry is more than 230 years old. It used to be called Conrad's Ferry. It dates back centuries, and this has been a critical transportation link between Maryland and Virginia across the Potomac River for our community and their community and the broader region. It's a key transportation link. It has always been a privately held entity, a private land, private operations, and a landing on the Virginia side, which is where the current dispute lies. And there is a little bit of a public role, but predominantly a private land dispute related to where that landing was and who controls it and how far it goes and whether or not a retaining wall, essentially, a relatively recent retaining wall was done under the current legal framework or not. And an 11-year-old court case that is in Loudoun County, has been in Loudoun County, has created the current dynamic that we're now in, which ultimately caused the ferry to be shut down and currently is shut down.
Is the White's Ferry a monopoly?
No, other people can run ferries. In fact, there used to be lots of ferries that crossed the Potomac River over the course of the couple centuries. Many of those ferries, all of which were privately run and privately held, ultimately stopped operating. And this is the one remaining ferry that has lasted the test of time and still is in operation.
That's interesting. So it could be that Rocklands Farm, which is contesting, which owns the land on the Virginia side, could start their own ferry, right?
Yeah, they could start their own ferry. I think more likely you would have the operation on the Maryland side finding a new landing, because the issue on the Virginia side isn't the operation of the ferry. It's simply the access point for a landing that ultimately then connects to public roads and whether or not there is access to that land, which is currently considered private property and under this ongoing legal dispute. The challenge with that is time. Right. That you can't set up a ferry operation overnight. You can't purchase land overnight. You can't take land by eminent domain overnight if the public sector were to get involved. And so that really is the challenge. We have two interests here. One is the long-term public good and public need that we need to make sure that we protect to avoid a situation like this from happening ever again. But much more immediately is the question of how quickly can we get this critical transportation link open and operating and running to serve the approximately 600 cars that utilize it every day. Also bicyclists, by the way, use this as well.
Has the White's Ferry enabled conservation in that area? That is that, it has allowed us not to build a bridge there that would have environmental impacts. Do you think that's been one of the benefits from the ferry?
Well, it's a key transportation link where there isn't otherwise a transportation link between the American Legion Bridge and Point of Rocks, which is a significant area. It is in the heart of the agricultural reserve, and I think that the ferry is in keeping with the conservation and land decision of the agricultural reserve. It is in conformance with that. A bridge would have significant challenges in terms of going through the agricultural reserve, not only from an environmental standpoint, but just a practical standpoint. I think that it is an appropriate transportation link to reflect what we have decided on the Maryland side in particular to be agricultural reserve conservation land in that area.
Yeah, so it'd be very difficult for somebody to actually get land on the Maryland side to run another ferry, right?
Yeah, I think it would be challenging to get the land. I think it would be challenging to create another operation. I think the most likely dynamic is if a landing on the Virginia side were not to be able to be worked out, which I believe it will be worked out. I actually think that we're in much better shape today than we were last week.
Right.
Are in a much better situation than we otherwise would have been. There's still work to do. There's still things that need to be worked out, but ultimately the dynamic here is you have one of the most prominent members of the Loudoun County community who has purchased the Maryland side and now needs to work out the Loudoun County side, but is better positioned than the prior owner would have been, or frankly, any of us would have been in order to do that. And also somebody who has demonstrated a significant interest in conservation efforts. This is an individual private owner, but who has bought numerous farms and a number of, thousands and thousands of acres of Loudoun County farmland and put it into a perpetual conservation easement so it can't be developed, which is, not exactly, a lucrative decision, but is certainly a community-oriented decision and one that, I think is a really important synergy with White's Ferry, which has significant conservation, but also historical significance and benefits to the community and to the region.
Yeah, you're talking about Chuck Kuhn of JK Moving, right? Of course, he's got a lot of monuments in Virginia. But, it raises a question whether this kind of critical infrastructure link should be based on some kind of altruistic purpose or should it not be self-sustaining?
Well, it certainly does raise the question of whether or not public goods and public assets should be privately held and controlled. And the dynamic that we're in is a reflection of this reality. It's a challenge. It's something that we've had to work through. Ultimately, we can't change that overnight. As a general rule, I think it would be better to have critical transportation links that have significant public need and benefits to be controlled by public entities that have no other interests than the public's interests. Having said that, given the circumstance that we're in, I think this might be the next best thing, at least for the immediate opportunities to get the ferry up and running as quickly as possible. I will also say that the challenge that Montgomery County has and Maryland has, and I've been in constant meetings and have convened stakeholders and have been discussing this virtually nonstop over the last couple months since the ferry operation shut down, given its importance to the community that I represent and the broader county and region. The challenge that we have is there is almost no public role for the county and the state beyond our borders. And the land dispute here is beyond our borders. It's in Loudoun County and in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We don't even have a legal right to take that by eminent domain. Ultimately, Loudoun County and the Commonwealth of Virginia would have to do that. And so we are one or two steps removed from where the center of this legal dispute really is. Having said that, we have been in discussions with all sides and have brought everybody together, including the Secretary of Transportation, the County Director of Transportation, our county attorney, political officials at the state, county, and municipal level. Everybody is working towards a similar goal, but frankly, our role here is limited. But that does point out the challenge that this would be a much different dynamic if it were the state of Maryland, the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Loudoun County and Montgomery County officials working through an issue as opposed to what frankly is a legal dispute between two private parties with a significant public interest at stake.
That's right. It is a commercial dispute. There's no doubt about it. And it is absolutely the case that you guys are, at a remove from this. You know, I did not hear in the list that you mentioned of people getting together, Loudoun officials or Virginia officials. I assume they are included and that you are able to have meetings with them included.
Yeah, there have been a number of discussions, ongoing conversations with Loudoun County and state officials. It's largely colleague to colleague. So transportation officials talking, on both sides, county attorneys talking on both sides, state transportation officials talking on both sides, some conversations among political entities and officials as well. So there are conversations happening at every level, but ultimately we're, like I said, one or two steps removed, trying our best to facilitate. You know, we've also been in discussions with CNO Canal, which is a stakeholder and has an interest here, with the Park Service, which has an interest here, the Coast Guard, which plays a role here. You know, you asked earlier about this question of whether or not you just started a new ferry operation. The challenge with that is it would have to be licensed. The folks who captain the boat would have to get their licensing. It is a much more challenging process. It's not just a corner store that closes down and is serving the community a local benefit. And so another competing corner store opens up because they're not providing the type of service that the community needs. For better or for worse, this is a much more regulated, much more challenging environment, and something that has to work through, and something that is quite complicated. The last piece of it is the employees currently live on the site. Is part of the dynamic here as well. And so it's more challenging to be able to build the structures that you need and to be able to set things up the way that that you would need it. Simply moving one side or the other side is easier said than done, and would probably take months or years versus days or weeks, which is what the community desperately wants and needs.
Right. So it is a virtual monopoly given those circumstances. I mean, if National Park Service has to okay a new ferry, then, you know, that's a big hurdle to jump.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a virtual monopoly, but it does have significant barriers to entry, a challenging business. And the question is whether or not there is enough potential profit to justify the risk and the challenges of getting in for a private entity, which, you know, does beg the question that you raised earlier. Now, frankly, I'm not sure that the community would love the idea of having 100 ferries, across the river and kind of going back to, you know, historically where things have been. I'm not sure that the land use patterns currently would allow or even support that.
In organizing critical infrastructure, what does this dispute say about that? How should we organize our public-private partnerships to be able to do this correctly?
for building and maintaining critical infrastructure. And this is, you know, more of a common topic that we're having now. It used to be that the public sector in the United States did infrastructure. Prior to that, it was all private.
Correct.
And this dates back, frankly, to those times where there was very limited amount of public role in infrastructure.
Correct.
And then it changed, and it was almost exclusively a public side, and the private sector played only a limited role in basically contracting to do some of the work, but not necessarily controlling the assets, owning the assets, maintaining the assets. Now there's a hybrid. Some things are public, some things are private, some things are a combination of the two. And I think that there are questions of how you balance that. Ultimately, the type of scale of investment that we need in infrastructure is hard to do with the public sector alone. It is challenging to do with the public sector alone without significant investments that have to be paid for somehow. And whether or not there's a willingness by the public to pay for that in some form or fashion is an open question, and where you find that happy medium. In Europe, for instance, they have gotten much more successful and are way ahead of where the United States is on the idea of largely doing public-private partnerships for most public infrastructure. Where there are design, bid, build, operate, and maintain contracts where the public sector owns the asset, but everything else is handled by the private sector, and they take on all the risk. And so, I will say that we are starting to do that here, and we have faced a number of challenges.
Right. Can you speak to that, actually? I would love to hear about what you think about how this has to be done carefully.
Yeah, so the Purple Line obviously is one example that has faced a number of challenges. Fortunately, that is finally moving forward after a protracted and very public and somewhat ugly legal dispute. The commitment that the state has made that they're going to move forward no matter what is positive. The fact that most of the partners are still staying on, saves us from the most disruptive potential situation there. But the way that project was set up allowed for the opportunity for the private sector or part of the private sector partnership to basically walk away from the deal with less adverse impact to them than to taxpayers, than to the public. And that created a significant challenge where the upfront risk was assumed predominantly by the public side, by the taxpayers, and the long-term risk then is being assumed by the private sector to a significant extent. And you got to a breaking point where, because of a number of delays, some which were out of the control of the private sector, they walked because they didn't want to participate in that. Now, I feel very strongly that when you make a commitment, you should fulfill the commitment, and I have no sympathy for anybody in a deal that walks away from fulfilling that deal, not the entire private sector entity, which some of which are still in the deal, but the main contractor, which has since walked away, put the state and the project in a significant challenge that has been incredibly disruptive to the project and to the community and to our regional transportation infrastructure. But the deal was set up in such a way to allow that to happen. And that's something that we need to avoid. There are some serious lessons learned from how this deal was structured. I think it's a challenge to a certain extent. This is the largest, most significant public-private transit project in the United States. We were out in front on this, to a certain extent, I think can take the lessons that have been learned to make sure that they don't get repeated, and to make sure that we do more on the front end to protect the public interest to avoid the ability for a disruption like this from happening again. But I remain extremely focused on making sure that the Purple Line comes, because we need it as an east-west transportation connection, as an equity, environmental, and economic benefit of significance to the region, to Montgomery County, Prince George's and more broadly the region. We also need to make sure that all the commitments made are kept. And there were significant commitments made as part of this project, not just the timing of it, which is not going to be fulfilled, but a number of aspects as well, including like returning of the trail, for instance, which we need, and making sure that we have the type of reliability and level of transportation that we have been promised and that residents should expect for their investment.
Let me just push you a little bit on the issue of, upfront commitment. So one of the challenges is that in order to attract private investment, we often give them some sort of ability to make those decisions to be able to walk away, right? It's a way in which we attract the private partners. But if we close those holes, are you confident of being able to find the private partners that then make you move forward and actually complete a big project such as Purple Line?
It's not the perfect. We oftentimes look at a deal and say, okay, on a perfect scenario, this is what it's going to look like. This is the time frame. This is the cost. This is what we're going to get out of it. But the reality is almost never does that perfect scenario play out. And so the question is, have we protected ourselves from the likely scenario where it's not a perfect scenario? What happens if there are delays? What happens if there are cost overruns? What happens if there are challenges that come up? Who is on the hook? Who is left holding the bag? And what process have we set up to work through them? Again, that's a complicated dynamic. That is very difficult to figure out, but that's why we set up institutions. That's why we elect leaders. That's why we put people in place. That is implicit in the social contract and why I love politics. Even though the podcast is about hating politics, because to me, politics is about people.
Right.
It's about solving problems. That's what politics is. It's creating a social problem and trying to fix it. It's addressing those issues to serve people. That's what politics really is. That's what it means. We all do politics. And some of us do it in a more public place than others.
Yes. The one question that comes out of what you just said is, do you see the need for any change in the regulatory framework to allow you to do that? I mean, you mentioned that Europe, that they had figured it out, right? How is their regulatory framework different than ours? And what do we need to change to be able to get it right?
Two aspects of this. One is the regulatory framework of what you can and can't do and how things are done. And the other is the actual operationalizing and executing of that. In many ways, it's the legal side, the legislative side versus the executive and implementation side. That's the way that our system is set up. There are a lot of benefits to that system. Comes with challenges. I think there is room for analysis on both sides of that related to this project and future projects of ways to tweak and improve it. Ultimately, I don't think it means there should never be public-private partnerships. I also don't think it means there should always be public-private partnerships. I think there's a time and a place for public-private partnerships.
Getting back to White's Ferry, so you are optimistic about what's going to come out of the purchase of White's Ferry by Chuck Kuhn.
Yeah, I'm very optimistic of what's going to happen with White's Ferry in the immediate term. I think Chuck Kuhn is interested and has a demonstrated record, from his background of being really focused on historical and land conservation issues. And, I think really is stepping in to participate in that. I think that's a real benefit. I think now that he is taking over the Maryland side and has the credibility that he has on the Loudoun side, the ability to address the Loudoun County land dispute, I think becomes much clearer in terms of the light at the end of the tunnel. And so I'm hopeful that we can get this up and running moving forward. And then I think there's opportunities for improvements as well. And I think he'll bring a fresh perspective and there are new opportunities. I think this exercise had forced us also to think through creatively of different ways that we could approach this issue. I think there's opportunities for us to take what we have started to discuss, some of these conversations about what to do with the ferry, how we can use it to best benefit the community beyond just a commuter line across the river. And I think, long-term, I think there's real opportunities to work with Chuck Kuhn and his family.
Okay, so from what I read though, Chuck Kuhn has offered to buy a permanent easement from Rocklands Farms, which is the Loudoun side of things, right? And Rocklands Farms has resisted a permanent easement even when the Browns control the ferry. Do you think Chuck Kuhn would be able to square the circle?
I'm hoping, and I am optimistic. I really am. I will say the dynamic here is it's no longer a Maryland versus Virginia side. It's no longer a Montgomery County versus Loudoun side here. This is a very important, prominent, committed Loudoun County leader, philanthropically and business-wise, who has stepped in. And so it's Loudoun County with Loudoun County trying to work through this. So to speak, it's within the family. I think that makes it easier, number one. Number two, the two families on either side have been in a legal dispute for 11 years.
Sure.
It's very challenging to make a deal when you've been in a legal dispute for 11 years, in fairness to both sides. That has been a significant challenge. There's some bad blood there.
So were you ever concerned about the Confederacy associations with the ferry? And do you think that might change as well?
Well, I've been very vocal about the connections of Confederate issues in Montgomery County. In fact, I led the effort on the council for street renamings after Confederates in District 1, in Potomac in particular. The statue is no longer there. That is no longer in public view. I was not a fan by any stretch of the imagination with that being the welcome to Montgomery County and to Maryland, a Confederate statue. So I am glad that that is no longer there, although that originally was in the Rockville Public Square and moved there. But I'm glad that it's no longer in public view. And my personal preference would be that there be no associations and that be the permanent position moving forward. And, I haven't had any conversations with Chuck Kuhn about that, but, hopeful that that will be the case moving forward.
Well, thank you, Andrew Friedson. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for talking about White's Ferry and public-private partnerships. You are, as always, insightful. What does the White Ferry stoppage teach us? As Andrew Friedson pointed out, it raises the question of whether critical infrastructure should be in private hands and subject to commercial disputes. The ferry moved about 600 cars a day in a county of 1 million people. Is that critical? It was for those 600 people involved and their families. On the Montgomery side, the ferry is in what is called the Agricultural Reserve, roughly a third of the county's total land that has been set aside purely for conservation and agriculture use decades ago, and therefore is now off limits to development. Residents of the Ag Reserve believe at the time the county designated the area as off-limits to development, the county also made a commitment that the resulting low population density would not be used against them to deny them public services. The White's Ferry is clearly seen by the area's residents as part of that promise. And when a commercial dispute led the ferry to stop, you bet the residents called county leaders. The White's Ferry debacle came alongside the problems faced by the Purple Line. The Purple Line is a light rail project that connects Bethesda to Silver Spring, College Park, and well into Prince George's County. It would connect neighborhoods on the east-west axis in a region where most transportation links tend to radiate north-south out of Washington, D.C. The Purple Line became the country's biggest public-private transit partnership, where a consortium of private firms committed to build and then operate the trains on the line for a number of years. But in September 2020, the private consortium stopped construction because they wanted to be compensated for cost and time overruns. This raised the critical issue of how we structure public-private partnerships. And what happens when private firms walk away from unfinished projects? In the end, the state of Maryland had to cough up an additional $250 million to resolve contract disputes before construction on the project could begin again. As Andrew Friedson points out, we need the private investment to come into infrastructure. But we have to figure out a way to structure these agreements so that taxpayers are not left holding the bag at the end of the day. The landowners on the Loudoun side, Rocklands Farms, want a piece of the operations. And the new owner, Chuck Kuhn, and his family are asking Rocklands to sell them the land instead. I'll be right back with Andrew Sondry and the upcoming report. Hey, Andrew, how are things in Up County?
Hey, Sunil. Thanks so much for asking. One major piece of news affecting the Up County that I think has been glossed over in a lot of the recent coverage of events up here is the impact that the coronavirus pandemic is having on essential cultural institutions like sports teams. It feels like a major loss to this region.
What do you mean by loss?
The state of Maryland has taken two major blows leading into the 2021 seasons for Major League Baseball and the National Women's Soccer League, likely due to the economic fallout of COVID, or at least poorly timed so that it corresponds with that. The MLB announced what they're calling a realignment of the minor leagues starting in the 2021 season. That'll trade the current Confederation of Regional Leagues with what they're calling now the Professional Development League. And to be honest, the new structure of that is a little bit complicated and I don't fully understand it myself. But given that the leagues don't actually have names, I'll bet that the MLB doesn't quite understand it either. Notably absent from this new league are 42 of the formerly 160 teams in the minor league.
So how many did Maryland lose?
Maryland has long had six professional minor league teams, the Aberdeen Ironbirds, the Southern Maryland Blue Crabs, the Delmarva Shorebirds, the Hagerstown Suns, the Bowie Bay Sox, and the Frederick Keys.
I'm a Bay Sox fan. I go to their games all summer.
Yeah, they're a staple of cultural life in Maryland. And specifically here in the Up County, a lot of us are Frederick Keys fans. But with a new realignment, the Keys have lost their former affiliation with the Orioles and thusly their spot in a regional league. Now, fortunately for us, the sports team has not been shut down entirely. Instead, they've been moved to a new MLB draft league, which consists of six teams that are unaffiliated from specific major league partners, forming what's effectively an independent circuit of teams that's designed to showcase young prospects nationwide.
And the Bay Sox?
Oh, don't worry. The Bay Sox are fine. Along with the Shorebirds and the Ironbirds, they've been given a new home in the Professional Development League. The Southern Maryland Blue Crabs, because they're part of an independent league called the Atlantic League, weren't subject to the changes of the major leagues. The Hagerstown Suns, however, were not so lucky. They've been closed down with this new realignment and will not be returning in any form for the 2021 season.
Oh, no. What effect is this going to have on Hagerstown?
Well, it's an especially rough time now, given that for the baseball community there, because they've recently renovated their historic municipal stadium. I believe that was back in 2016. And they're in the process of getting approval to build a new stadium in town. Without the Suns, the entire project could go down the drain, along with the hundreds of thousands of dollars that the team brought in revenues to the city every year. And I believe they had like 9 permanent jobs and a bunch of part-time jobs. It's a major economic loss.
Oh, that's awful. And what about the women's soccer team? What happened there?
Yes. So I don't know how familiar you are with the Washington Spirit, but they are the DC-based women's soccer team in this area. They're actually the only professional sports team to call the Up County and Montgomery County writ large home. They trained and played at the Maryland Soccerplex in my hometown of Germantown.
Have they been closed too?
No, but they have switched their home stadium to Segra Field in Loudoun County, Virginia. They'd long been in talks to transition to Audi Field in DC, which can seat about 15,000 more people than the Soccerplex can and has a much more modern training center. But after a lengthy campaign and a promise to build a new training facility and create some new youth development programs, the Washington Spirit decided to move to Segra in Loudoun.
Well, what is the effect on Up County, you think?
As far as I could find, there haven't been any cost analyses to determine specifically how much revenues they bring into the area every year. So I don't want to pin an economic number on it. But it is a big blow to the community in a cultural sense. The Washington Spirit was a staple of life up here. And it was a big boost to youth sports leagues. And without them, the Soccerplex is going to become exclusively recreational complex. And it'll lose one of the major draws that it has for young people going there to play. From a team standpoint, though, the move makes a lot of sense. Loudoun County promised them the kinds of resources that they need to advance as a team and better promote their vision, their broader vision of encouraging young people and particularly young girls to play soccer. So it's unclear, at least to those of us who live up here, whether Montgomery County made the same kind of competitive offers, but we're going to be sad to see them go.
What does this say about local sports franchises?
I think that it highlights, first and foremost, just how important professional sports teams are to a community's sense of self. And second of all, just how vulnerable these kinds of cultural and economic institutions are to the myriad of financial and political forces that are just so hard to predict in the world today.
Thanks, Andrew. Where can folks reach you if they have a story to share?
You can reach out to me first on Twitter if you'd like. My handle is just at Andrew Saundry. My last name is spelled S-A-U-N-D-R-Y. It's the same as laundry, but replace the L with an S. So I tell people to remember it. But you can also email me at saundry.andrew@gmail.com.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your first report. I'm looking forward to having you on the show regularly. If you want to write to the show, email us at ihppod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I want to thank the guys at Ed's Not Dead Podcast for pointing me to this journey into podcasting, and AJ Campbell for early help, including making the logo art. Our music comes from the local band Soul Witness. I'm very much looking forward to showcasing local talent and especially local music students on the podcast. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone who might want to do it, please email us at ihppod@gmail.com or reach out on Twitter at ihppod. I hope you will subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and your home. See you next time.